Welcome to Archway's Western Civilization History Podcast. In our podcast, we look for the best of the West and discuss the stories, events, themes, and people that made the West different from the rest. It's a brand new year and our 50th episode. To celebrate this historic milestone and say thanks to the hundreds of listeners who've enjoyed our podcast thousands of times and supported us through thick and thin, this is an extra special celebratory episode on the history of the spoken word, beginning with its origins as the oral tradition and the changes it underwent over the course of the millennia, including integrating poetry, stock phrases, alliteration, homilies, and music, and later leveraging technology like radio, automobiles, and the internet, until finally evolving into its final form, the podcast. To begin, according to Encyclopedia.com, the oral tradition refers to a society's folklore, legends, tales, taboos, and stories through which knowledge of the past is preserved and transmitted from one generation to another. It is an ancient practice originating from the earliest civilizations that continues to this day. The oldest still preserved oral traditions are said to come from the Aboriginal Australians. They have stories describing a time when islands like Tasmania were peninsulas, when their ancestors hunted 7-foot-tall giant birds, and when volcanoes were active and erupting. All of these memories are over 10,000 years old. One of the oldest oral traditions in Western civilization was the Oral Torah. According to Rabbinic Judaism, in addition to the laws written by Moses in his 5 books, God also revealed to Moses additional statutes and legal interpretations regarding agriculture, marriage, and civil and criminal laws. Now, Moses lived in the 13th century BC. These traditions passed from generation to generation orally for 1,400 years until someone finally wrote it all down, Rabbi Judah the Prince in the 3rd century AD. This written work was called the Mishnah, and it is the basis for the Talmud, which is another holy book of the Jewish faith. The oral law was legal knowledge, but many of the most famous oral traditions of the West relate to mythical and historical knowledge.
Do you find that the stories of your ancestors drag a little? Are they hard to remember? Do you need your kids to have that little something else to make them listen to the Golden Age? Try poetry! With poetry, you can remember every heroic thing Ajax did without even writing it down. Poetry is also flexible enough to add additional details about the grandparents of your specific audience. And if you buy the deluxe edition, we'll upgrade your poetry to theater for free, no questions asked. Poetry, a rhyme in time makes you just fine.
At the pinnacle of these are the Iliad and the Odyssey. These stories long predated Homer. Nevertheless, it was Homer's version of the retelling that was preserved by history, and so we remember him as the author of the story. Homer lived in Athens in the 8th century BC. He was not a historian or a priest, but a poet, a traveling bard who sang these verses to the tune of his lyre. And as such, his first obligation was to entertain his audience. In spite of this, his narrative remained consistent, not changing from telling to telling the way a dad might change an improvised bedtime story every night. According to AncientOrigins.net, it was through poetic verse and the use of repetition that Homer was able to maintain an almost consistent and fluid narrative in every performance. About 300 years after Homer's life, these stories were finally written down. As we see in the Iliad, having rhymes and melodies is a common tool of orators to help memorize all the details of their story. Another device of the oral tradition is the story-starting phrase. These stock phrases exist in almost every culture and language. In English, ours is, "Once upon a time." This phrase has been used in some form since AD 1380 and was the starting expression for most stories from the 1600s, and especially for the 19th century fairy tales written by Hans Christian Andersen, who was the author of The Princess and the Pea, Thumbelina, The Emperor's New Clothes, and The Little Mermaid. Many of these stories also end with the stock phrase, "and they lived happily ever after." This same tradition to have these starting and ending phrases is seen in Arabic, Chinese, Farsi, Japanese, Guarani, Hebrew, and across Europe. Some languages, however, have interesting divergences. In Korean, a typical fairy tale begins, "Once in the old days when tigers smoked." In Catalan, spoken in the northeast of Spain, a story may start with, "Once upon a time in a corner of the world where everybody had a nose." In Kazakh, they start with, "A long, long time ago when goats had feathers." In Goamai, a language spoken in Nigeria, they say, "Story, story," to which the children reply, "Story." The orator then goes on to say, "A long time ago, in the days of our ancestors, when men were men and women tended the kitchen." In Icelandic, they often close their stories with, quote, "A cat in the bog put up his tail, and there ends this fairy tale," close quote. Anyway, because of the oral tradition's rhetorical tricks like the stock phrase, it continued well into the medieval period. In each society, however, it looked a little different. In Northern Europe, the oral tradition took on alliteration as a way to remember the story. This is first seen in the Old English poem of Beowulf, produced at the end of the 10th century AD. It employed many phrases such as, "Were the bold of both after battle's brunt." 600 years later, this tradition was employed by old Bill Shakespeare with the prologue to Romeo and Juliet, where he said, "From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, whose misadventures piteous overthrows doth with their death bury their parents' strife." In the ancient Christian world, the oral tradition embraced homily, which is when a layman reads a sacred text and then delivers a public explanation of the text. There was also sermonizing for those who were ordained priests and ministers. Sermons are much longer and more structured speeches than homilies. They integrate many verses and narratives into a single speech. Some of the oldest sermons would last several hours, and they utilize techniques of both rhetoric and the theater. These have fallen out of favor now, as people prefer speeches to not exceed 40 minutes or so, and would balk at a theatrical performance occurring in the middle of church. But back in the Middle Ages, their brains were just wired differently. In fact, some sermons were so invigorating that they could change the course of history, such as Pope Urban II's speech to the French knights that inspired them to retake the Holy Land. After the Protestant Reformation, where the Eucharist was no longer as important and salvation came by faith alone, the sermon took on a central importance to the worship service. This is because literally a single sermon could now save someone's soul if it caused them to accept Jesus in their heart. Spoken word was also adapted into the early opera. Galileo's dad, Vincenzo Galilei, was a musician in Pisa in the 16th century. Influenced by the writings of the ancient Greeks, he wanted to recreate the old manner of storytelling and drama. He thus pioneered the use of a single melodic line to tell the story, accompanied by simple chords from a harpsichord or lute. This evolved into the recitative, a rhythmically free vocal style that imitates the natural inflections of speech, and this method became a crucial part of the operas of Mozart, Bach, Vivaldi, Wagner, and many more. In the modern era, the oral tradition reached new heights. No longer was an orator confined to share their words with a crowd on a street corner, or an opera house, or a chapel congregation. No, by the early 1900s, their voice could be transmitted from miles away. And by the end of the 20th century, the voice of the common man could easily be transmitted across oceans and the entire world. This necessitated a new way to describe an orally disseminated story. The word that was picked was broadcast. In the 1700s, the term broadcast meant to throw seeds upon the ground by hand. It was a term for farmers to explain how they planted their crops. But like many farming terms, by the end of the 18th century, it had developed a figurative use, being used to mean something that was widely spread. A few decades later, electrical transmitters, receivers, and conductors were developed and started being used to send simple messages across vast distances by wire. For example, in 1867, when the last spike was hammered into the Transcontinental Railroad in Ogden, Utah, the spike was wired into a telegraph machine, allowing listeners across the country to hear each hammer pounding the spike until finally the message "done" was transmitted. Just a few years later, thanks to the research into electromagnetic radiation by Heinrich Hertz and the tinkerings of Tesla and Marconi and many others, this method of communication evolved into radio telegraphy. Radio, from the Latin word radius, meaning beam, and telegraph, from Greek meaning far recording, literally a far recording transmitted through a beam of radiation. Using a radio receiver, you could now receive wires wirelessly through the airwaves. In 1900, the first wireless transmission of the human voice was accomplished by a Catholic priest and inventor named Roberto Landel de Moura. In his native Brazil, he transmitted his voice over 4 miles in a public demonstration. By 1920, this feat had been replicated thousands of times, and this was the year that the first news programs were being spoken over by the radio. These were called broadcasts, since their voice, like thrown seeds, was being disseminated far and wide. Arguably, the nation's oldest and longest-running broadcast, which still runs to this day, was Music and the Spoken Word, broadcast on KSL. First broadcasted in 1922, Music and the Spoken Word has, for over 100 years, consisted of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing beloved Christian hymns, accompanied by the Salt Lake Tabernacle organ and the orchestra at Temple Square. Interspersed with the songs are spiritual messages and homilies related to each episode's theme. Among the most famous of the early broadcasts were the radio addresses that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave to the United States public during the difficult years between 1933 and 1944. In these fireside chats, Roosevelt spoke directly to the public, allowing him to quell rumors, counter critics, and explain his policies without being interrupted or misconstrued. Up to 60 million people listened to his chats, such as the first one and the one after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. This accounted for about 40 to 50% of the U.S. population. He regularly had 70% of the radio audience listening to what he had to say. A huge innovation that hit radio in the 1930s and has preserved to this day was the invention of the car radio in 1930 by the Galvin brothers, Paul and Joseph. These two entrepreneurs called their radio Motorola, coining its name from the terms automotive and Victrola, which was a machine for playing records. I think we probably all have fond memories of Dad listening to Car Talk on NPR or Rush Limbaugh on AM radio on those long car rides to Home Depot in the 90s.
Music. Theater. Stories. Politics. All these things can be yours from the comfort of your own home. Maybe you're tired of listening to Rebecca tell her lousy stories. Or maybe you want to be a metropolitan person who knows theater and songs, but you don't want to go to plays and concerts. Maybe your face is too ugly to be seen on a stage. Try radio, an auditory listening experience, where you can listen to music, stories, songs, and all kinds of things from the comfort of your own home. You can listen to the esteemed voice of Winston Churchill or the beautiful pipes of Ella Fitzgerald. With radio, you can hear it. Radio, you're listening for us.
Two big innovations that came in the new millennium were RSS feeds in 2000 and the iPod in 2001. RSS feeds allow users to access updates to websites and internet broadcasts from across the web and update them all in a single spot. These allowed not only for the creation of news aggregators, but also the dissemination of digital broadcasts. The iPod, though not the first portable MP3 device, was revolutionary in how small and easy to use it was, as well as its seamless integration with iTunes, a software that acts as both a media library and a device management tool. By 2004, iTunes and the iPod were fully integrated into RSS feeds, allowing listeners to access the most updated versions of the broadcasts that they liked the most. Simultaneously, the internet's democratizing effects were impacting the broadcasting industry. No longer did you have to be an established radio disc jockey or journalist to get an audio program. With the internet, anyone could become an audio blogger and find an audience on any topic. Ben Hammersley, while writing an article about these enthusiastic audio bloggers for The Guardian, coined the portmanteau of podcast by combining the words iPod and broadcast. Soon these audio bloggers became known as podcasters who podcast podcasts. In the past 20 years, podcasting has taken the world by storm. There are now over 4 million podcasts worldwide. Over a third of Americans listen to podcasts at least once a month. In fact, there are 10 million more weekly podcast consumers than there are Netflix accounts, 80 million versus 70 million. About 30 million of those listeners are on Spotify, and another 30 million are on Apple. The world's most popular podcast, The Joe Rogan Experience, has over 15 million subscribers and 3 billion views. The most popular location to listen to podcasts is at home, followed by a car, and then walking. 7 out of 10 listeners prefer not to do anything while listening to a podcast. Nevertheless, 60% of listeners will listen while doing housework, and 52% will listen while driving. The most popular podcast topic is comedy. In spite of its popularity, podcasting isn't too big a business yet, but it's certainly growing. 2 years ago, it was a $1 billion industry. Now it is a $4 billion industry. By comparison, though, Halloween is an $11 billion industry, and video streaming is a $150 billion industry. I'm not sad about this, though. Part of the joy of podcasting is that anyone with a computer, a microphone, and a voice can do it. And most of us only make a few bucks a year. And we're happy to do it, because it's not about the money. It's about connecting with an audience and sharing something you're passionate about. And with that, I'll conclude our podcast for the day. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward excitedly to our next 50 episodes over the next few years. This year, we will cover exciting topics like medieval queens in Europe, Ethiopia's Solomonic dynasty. We'll put on trial Christopher Columbus and other explorers, figure out what's the deal with the Leaning Tower of Pisa, discover the golden age of sailing, study old Bill Shakespeare, and learn more about chess history. If there's a topic you're interested in, feel free to email us at archwayspodcast@gmail.com or comment in our feedback section. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a 5-star review for us and share with a friend. For more information on this topic, check out the sources listed in the description. I'm Doug Archway, and that is history for you.